So where to begin? So when we think about, so maybe the part of the topic that I talk about often is this idea of a war on emotion. So what do I mean by that? And so if we look at our culture, and it may be a bit of an overgeneralizing, but if we look at the bigger picture, it's fairly safe to say that we have declared a kind of war against emotions, unpleasant mind states, any sort of internal conflict or even suffering, any sort of unpleasant experience that I have. Here what we do is it tends to be pathologized. So if I'm having a hard time in my life for a variety of reasons, it tends to, there can be a diagnosis, there can be a pathology, there can be a way in which if I'm having a hard time that I must be doing something wrong. And so we don't see the pharmacology industry and a lot of these industries haven't, they've succeeded so well as a result of this phenomenon, and that we really have a tendency to become overly obsessed and overly pathologizing of the difficulty that we have internally, whether it could be a psychological, it could be emotional, it could be in our relational, but any of the difficulties we have in our life, we kind of really go to war against it. We don't want that to be. We engage in behaviors to avoid that, to change that, to control that. And culturally, we have become very interested in studying how badly people do. We're very interested in diagnosing and why do people do so bad and what are the causes of why people do so bad. But really actually not so interested in what are the causes of well-being. Which is one of the things that the Dalai Lama, when he wanted to bring the monks into the laboratory and study them in the fMRI, he said, can we find what are the causes of well-being? How good can people do? And what are the things, what are the qualities that allow us to flourish and to be happy? What are those? And we haven't done much of that here in the United States in sort of really modern culture. We're much more interested in the other thing. The other reason I think this is important, especially around emotion, is that one thing that I could say that if you hear me say anything tonight, it would be really helpful to hear this, and I think it's been a problem, is we really have to be careful and we have to stop categorizing emotions as being negative and positive. We have negative emotions and we have positive emotions. We actually just have emotion. And actually, as a system, emotions are, they're ethically neutral. There's no qualitative value to them from the view of emotion. The question becomes, do I have a constructive relationship to the emotion, or do I have a destructive relationship to the emotion? So anger is a good example. Most people would categorize anger as a negative emotion, and I shouldn't get angry. But anger is a universal human emotion. We all have it. It's not going anywhere. You're not going to get rid of it. The question becomes, when I become angry, do I have a regrettable emotional episode, is the language we use? Do I feel bad later about what I did or said when I became angry? Do I have these destructive emotional outcomes when I'm angry? Or can I have a constructive response to that emotional experience? And this really changes the way that we think about emotions, because a lot of us would think, well, anger is negative, shame is negative, sadness not so good either. And all of a sudden the whole list is just like, emotions just become sort of negative. And they become this problem that we need to solve. And this thing I need to get rid of. And it becomes a little bit pathologized. And one thing we know about them is they're here to stay. They have a role, they have an evolutionary role, we have them for a reason. And when we're lost in the grips of them, when we're having the intensity of an emotion, a lot of times we don't have access to our prefrontal cortex and we don't have our wits about us. And have you ever had an emotional episode, you can really, really emotional and you kind of get spit out the other side 20 minutes later, an hour later, and you go, what the hell was that all about? What was I thinking? How did that actually happen? I can't believe I said that to my wife or my friend. You're like, well, because during that experience, you were lost in the grips and the intensity of that. We weren't able to work through that. And so we want to, the reason why I like this metta of Vipassana or these heart practices has been such a tremendous part of my practice is they've really helped me work with my emotional experience. And so when we talk about one of the outcomes, one of the contemplative outcomes of this that we see really in, I would say, all forms of contemplative practice or Buddhist practice, especially here as it's kind of taken root in the States, is, and also one thing I want to say when I say spiritual bypass, I really don't mean for this to be a derogatory term. It's not really, because now it's just another pathology, right? Now I'm spiritual bypassing and I need to stop doing that. See how quickly it just, everything falls into this, like, I need to stop doing business. Spiritual bypass is not a derogatory term. It's something that happens to all of us, but it's a way in which we consciously or unconsciously can use contemplative or meditative techniques to avoid or to repress emotional experiences that we don't want to feel. And you can get really good at it, actually. I've gotten very good at it. I will cop to the fact that I think I didn't feel sadness for almost a decade. And there were some side effects that weren't great. I actually happened to be single 8 of those 10 years during that time. I'm not going to get into that right now. That's a $250 an hour person conversation, so we'll politely leave that aside. But it turns out the role of sadness, evolutionary, the reason we have sadness is to elicit connection from others. Oops. Guess I dropped the ball on that one. So there's a way in which we can really use, you know, things like attention, things like certain practices, to suppress or to avoid or to really not sort of not deal with or not want to feel with these emotions that are difficult for us, which sometimes can feel successful. You're like, yeah, I've been practicing this meditation. I'm less angry. It's really working out. I don't explode so much. And maybe that's happening in a constructive way, or maybe there's a suppression happening. And so there's a way in which it's not like we have to stop doing this, but we want to become more aware, perhaps, of ways in which we might be using our practice of meditation as a strategy or a tool to avoid our really innate human experiences that we're all subject to. And to some degree, I, and again, not to blame anybody, but if we look at sort of the history of, you know, sort of when Americans are really sort of affluent Americans, sort of, you know, white middle-class Americans maybe, started really practicing in the 70s, whether it was Tibetan Buddhism or insight meditation, when it kind of started taking off, we were introduced to this idea of enlightenment, and that Buddhism is all about enlightenment. And when I hear enlightenment, I assume that enlightenment means I'm not going to have any more unpleasant emotions. I'm not going to have bad feelings. I'm going to end suffering. I'm going to be all better now. And when I master the Buddhist meditation techniques, all of this difficult emotional experience is going to not be a problem for me anymore. And I'm just going to be sort of, to some degree, we go at it as if we want kind of an emotional lobotomy. And you know, to no fault of nobody, but when I hear enlightenment, I'm like, yeah, cool, this sounds like Buddhist heaven. I mean, they can take on that tone. And so as the practices have been, practice hasn't really been that long, it's no surprise that we find people who are leaders in Buddhist communities or people who are practitioners can really develop in a very big way this kind of tendency to have a spiritual bypass, which can look a lot like equanimity, which as we know, equanimity is this evenness of mind and body. And one thing about that that's so difficult and so destructive is equanimity. There's a near enemy of equanimity, which is that of indifference or a kind of apathy. So people who can appear to be very equanimous, very calm, very at ease in the face of adversity, very awakened, enlightened beings, could actually give it, they could totally care less. it's not that they're equanimous, but there's a sense of like, I don't, whatever. I don't really care. There's an indifference, a cold indifference, an apathy about that, which is actually a fairly large. To be able to do that, you really have to do a lot of work to be able to shut down emotion. You know, there's a lot of suppression that needs to happen for one to be able to do that. Again, I don't mean this to be derogatory. I don't think people sit down and go, okay, I'm gonna get into meditation so I can learn how to suppress all my emotions that I don't want to feel. It's not like we got into it to do that, but it can be a kind of byproduct if we're not careful. I was teaching at, last year when I was here, I was teaching at 1440 up the street in Scotts Valley with one of my friends and colleagues, Dharma teacher George Haas, that many of you know, who's a really, really fabulous Dharma teacher. I think he's actually one of the most underutilized Dharma teachers. Brilliant teacher who really integrates Dharma into a lot of science around attachment theory and meaningful life. We were at this, teaching this retreat. And also at the retreat was Gabor Mate. Gabor Mate and Adi was teaching a retreat, and there was like, you know, five people in me and George's retreat, and like, you know, 80 people in Gabor Mate's retreat. He was a big draw, Gabor. Many of you probably know Gabor or know who he is. But there was a public lecture between Gabor Mate and Adyashanti, who's a meditation teacher, I think, in really in the Zen tradition. And they were having a conversation about spiritual bypass was the topic. And so 1440 invited me and George and said, would you guys like to go to this lecture? And of course we were like, yeah, of course we want to go to this lecture. And so the topic is spiritual bypass. There's this sort of renowned Zen teacher on the stage in Gabor Mate, who's a medical doctor and does a lot of work with trauma. And Gabor Mate asks Adyashanti the first question. He says, so Adyashanti, tell me, how is it, Adyashanti, that in the Buddhist tradition we have all these so-called enlightened masters, these awakened beings, as they're called, and these people who have achieved this spiritual awakening, this spiritual enlightenment. How is it, Adyashanti, that we have all these people in the world of Buddhism who have done that, but who are actually engaging in sexual abuse with their students, who are having abusive relationships with their students, they're having power dynamics with their communities, they're actually causing a lot of harm. How is it possible that you could have some sort of awakened spiritual enlightenment and also engage in these very destructive, harmful behaviors? And you can look on the look of Adyashanti's face. He was not very happy about this question. It's the first question of the night. And he, you know, he kind of went back and forth a little bit, and he said this thing that sort of made me and George cringe, where he said, on one level, he said, people can be very, very enlightened and very, very spiritually advanced on one level, and on another level, they can be very, very spiritually or immature or unaware. And of course, I completely and totally reject that idea. That's really not, there's something else happening in that dynamic that's not this level system. That there's something really, really off with the individual. Because if we look at the Dharma tradition, and of course, there was a lot of questions and I wanted to ask him a question, but I didn't get a chance to, and it's probably good that I didn't. But part of it was this question, okay, so if we look at the Buddhist tradition and we look at Dharma practice, we learn very quickly that the core of the practice is that of sila, is really where the practice begins, is this sila, which is this intentional way in which we engage in our life in a way where we're taking a fairly big commitment to live a life of harmlessness, a life of ethics, a life of where we're not, where we're recognizing the suffering of the world and where we're making this commitment to say, I really want to make sure that I'm not contributing to more of that. And so this is really kind of, as you all know, sila samadhi panya, it's really pretty much Dharma 101. Do no harm as best you can. And so how you can be spiritually enlightened and actually participating in harm on a bodily level. There's no awareness, there's no, in that exchange with another human being, that there's a lack of awareness that harm is being created. To call that enlightenment or spiritual enlightenment, I think is a tragedy. Obviously, there's something happening in that person's experience that is not being accessed. There's a probably tremendous a tremendous disconnect, which is why I think the word spirituality can be problematic, because really what Dharma practice is all about embodiment. It's about actually being in your body. It's not a disconnection. It's not being up here in some other privileged realm. It's actually about being right into your bones, into your hands, into our relationship and how we connect and exchange with other people. And of course, if we look at the tradition, we look at the foundations of mindfulness, everything starts with the body. We're being in our bodies in a way that feels kind and compassionate and appreciative. And so, and at the same time that we were at this lecture, it was very sort of auspicious. There was lots of this going on in actually various communities, Dharma communities around the country. There was this kind of little epic episode of it happening in a bunch of different communities and a bunch of different fallout with different teachers and from all different traditions and so on and so forth. And it was interesting to be at this lecture with somebody from really the older school who, you know, and I have nothing against Adyashanti. I don't mean to be judgmental of him. I'm glad I wasn't up there with Gabor Mate having to deal with these questions. But I think he wrestled and did the best he could to do that. But there is this way in which we can separate that with this idea that somebody can somehow be really, really advanced on some level and really, really kind of harmful and destructed on another level. It just seems very sort of impossible to me. I really can't wrap my head around that one. Especially when we think about the component of integrity and ethics and really this kind of idea, harmlessness. Shouldn't be that hard to get that one down. You know? And most of us, you know, we get that one down. And one of the things that's really interesting about practice is a lot of times people I work with, the students that I work with, a lot of people I've worked with who have addiction and trauma and have been through some really, really difficult experiences in their life. A lot of these people I know who have really tremendous integrity. They've overcome so much adversity. They've been through so much shit. And the way that they act in the world is very, very harmless. But they don't give themselves very much credit for that. Because their meditation practice isn't going well, or they're having difficulty in their emotions. They're having some suffering still, they're having some difficulty. And they're so preoccupied with wanting to get that right that there's a way in which a lot of us as Dharma practitioners, lay practitioners, who take this practice seriously, we don't reflect or we don't give ourselves credit or we don't acknowledge the beauty in our lives of the way that we live and our action and our speech and in the way that we've made a commitment to being harmless. We somehow think that getting the psycho-emotional experience, you know, under control is maybe more important. And we can just overlook this reality of sila, which sometimes translated as ethics, but I think of it as two things, as it's a discipline. We have a discipline to our own sense of integrity or our values. So reflecting on our values of harmlessness or of kindness or whatever you are. Everybody in the room may be a little different. It's not about ascribing to the Buddhist list, but it's about actually really feeling into your own sense of what your values are and then being able to live from those values and having some discipline around being honest and having integrity in your relationships and in your relationship to money, in your relationship to the planet, and all of these things that a lot of us are probably doing very well in that territory, but there's no gratitude, there's no sense of feeling good about oneself as a result of that. Maybe this isn't true for you, but I find this to be true in lots of Dharma communities and lots of people that I work with who I'm like, people who give themselves a hard time, I'm like, man, you are really doing well. You're like living really, really well. You're living with a lot of integrity. You've overcome so much stuff. and you're giving yourself a hard time because your mind wanders when you meditate, that's the fucking problem. Right? It's like we get it back asswards. It's like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. Forgot about that one. And so there's this part of the work that we do in cultivating emotional balance that really comes out of this idea of sila and harmlessness is what's in cognitive science called cognitive intelligence. And cognitive intelligence is this beautiful idea where when we think about sort of the Eightfold Path, it's sort of like we start with right view. So we have the right view, and the right view is maybe to be harmless, right? So we hold that as a view. We hold that as a value. My value, harmlessness. And then I try to bring that into my intentions. Because I value harmlessness, I'm going to try to be careful around my intentions and recognizing intentions I have that are maybe rooted in ill will or rooted in greed or rooted in jealousy, that are rooted in something that aren't in line with my values, actually. And then from that place, I try not to act or to speak or to act on those destructive intentions. And if I'm able to kind of complete the task, my value is harmlessness, my intention is harmlessness, and I'm able to speak and act in a way, when I get to follow through, that's what's called cognitive intelligence or cognitive balance. It means that my values and my actions are congruent. It's a beautiful thing. It's actually one of the constituents for happiness. That happiness, one of the ingredients of happiness is a cognitive intelligence, is that my values in this life and my actions are aligned. And when we see that, when we see the fruition of that, we feel good about ourselves. If we're aware of it, if we have made a choice to pay attention to that, if we actually are letting that be part of our Dharma path, part of our Dharma practice. And so there's a way in which we can see, and I actually have had to learn how to pay attention to that. Because I'm one of those people who can, I've put a lot of energy, I've been in recovery for a long time, I try to be generous, I try to be kind, but a lot of times when I'm being generous or I'm being kind or I'm in the experience of compassion, I have this attitude of like, well, I should be doing this anyway. Like, I don't get any credit for doing the right thing. But, you know, if you look around, not everybody's trying. I think, in fact, to a large degree, most people aren't even trying. So the fact that we even trying is, I think, a tremendous value to ourselves and to the world, that we're even trying to do the right thing. And so we can kind of start to see how this works. And so what that can do, part of spiritual bypass in the behavioral sense is ways in which we're engaging in harmful behaviors where we might feel like we have the right intention, but we're not being aware of the impact on the other person. So there is this dynamic between there's intention and there's also impact. And if you cause somebody harm, you don't get to decide that you didn't. That's not your role. So this is where it gets complicated, is that we can actually sometimes, and we've all had those experiences, have you ever had the best intentions with somebody and you said something and it didn't land so good? And the impact of what was said, even though the intention was good, was honest and felt good, the impact it had on the other person was harmful. Right? And our job is not to go, well, hey man, that's not what I meant. You took it the wrong way. Clearly, it's your problem. That's not really constructive. That's almost a really wonderful example of a destructive outcome. So there's a way in which we do have to take responsibility for our intentions, but we also have to be responsible and aware and compassionate and concerned with others enough to a degree that we can begin to see the impact that our actions and our speech has on the people around us. And of course, this is so important and a great practice when it comes to the people that you're close to. people, you know, in your marriage, in your family, in your friend circles, in your Dharma communities. There's a way in which we can begin to be a little bit more responsible for the intentions that we have and the impact they have on other people. So if we kind of just think about that for a minute, this is, I think, a big part of practice that gets tremendously overlooked. And so when we start to think about things like mindfulness, where does mindfulness fit into this equation? Part of mindfulness is to, the Pali terms sati means something like to relax, to recollect, or to remember. But it's not just to remember to recognize the present moment experience, which is mostly what we associate mindfulness with is present time awareness, right? That's kind of what it's become. Live in the now, just be in the now. And everything will work out. Really? I'm not so convinced that just being in the now is going to solve all my problems. So it's been really, of course, totally and tremendously watered down. But if you look at sort of the way that the Dalai Lama, who I've been really inspired by in the last couple of years, and his really view on secularity, he's almost a bit of a heretic, the Dalai Lama, because he's so informed and interested in these Western contemplative wisdom traditions of science and neuroscience, and really kind of a fascinating person. But his part of that is remembering and to recollect. Part of that, a huge aspect of mindfulness, is to remember and to recollect our sense of values and purpose. So sati, to remember, to recognize, what we're wanting to remember, to recognize constantly is our sense of values and our sense of integrity, is really our sila. How mindful am I of that? Or do we just sort of check that off of like, well, I'm a Buddhist, of course I have the sila. Really? Do you? It's not a belief system, it's a behavioral system. And so remembering to recognize that sense of... And this goes both ways, because A, on one hand, when we do live integrity, and a lot of us, I think I would probably argue, everybody in this room is probably trying pretty hard to be a good person. But when we remember to recognize that, we feel a sense of gratitude and appreciation, and we this sort of mudita, sympathetic joy about ourselves and our lives and the way that we're living. And on the other side of that, when we remember to recognize that, we're becoming more aware of these outcomes that are harmful to other people, and we're more likely or more quickly to make a repair or to make a remedy or to say, oh, actually, you know what, I regret that exchange that we had. I feel bad about how I spoke or how I acted. I'm sorry. And I don't know if you've ever been have you ever been harmed by somebody and they come back and acknowledge it? It feels pretty good, doesn't it? You're like, oh wow. Doesn't happen maybe as much as we'd like it to, but it does feel quite good. And so what are some of the ways out of these trappings? One of the ways out of these trappings around spiritual bypass and around just being aware of ways in which we might be avoiding is really another type of intelligence, is sort of emotional intelligence, which is really not that, it's a fairly simple concept. It's just knowing when you're emotional. It turns out to be really helpful, because we're not always emotional, and we're mostly not emotional. But when we are emotional, being aware of the arising of that emotion, being able to recognize it, and like we talk about in the third foundation of mindfulness, where the Buddha's instruction is to recognize, I have anger in my mind, I have greed in my mind, I have delusion in my mind, right? Recognizing this introspective awareness of what is it that's in my mind right now, being able to recognize, I'm angry right now, I have anger in my mind. I probably need to be careful about what I do or say right now. Because when I'm angry, I often do things and say things that I regret later. I need to be careful. I also perhaps want to remember to recognize in this mindfulness that my intention and my values is to be harmless. And that's mindfulness on the go, mindfulness in action. Saying, okay. And what that does is it allows us to reappraise the situation. It allows us to look at the present moment experience in a little bit of a different way. There's a term in Vipassana practice, I forget what it is, where they talk about practice as something, as a repeatedly looking at, to repeatedly look at over and over again. So as we do that with the breath, we do that with the body, we constantly repeatedly look at something. And every time we look at something, our perspective about that changes just a little bit. And really part of the definition of meditation is to familiarize the mind with objects. And so there can be a way, one of the ways that we have insight into our experience, or we begin to have knowledge into our experience, is when we become familiar with aspects of our experience that we're not aware of or that we don't know much about. And a lot of that I have found to be emotion. What do you know about your experience with something like shame? That will silence the room relatively quickly. It's like, I'm not familiar with that at all. I actually don't want anything to do with that. I want to get rid of that. So there's an aversion. And as we all probably know by now, aversion is not a tool for liberation. So when we think about practice in that way, it's like any time that we're pushing away an object that arises, we're not familiarizing. There's a quality of a denying. There can be a sort of denial. I don't feel shame. I don't get sad. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a Buddhist meditator. I've overcome that. Don't do that anymore. I have officially learned how to suppress that emotion every time it arises. Thank you very much. There's not a familiarity with that experience. And so when we start to think about, what are the factors, what are the things that allow us, what are the situations in our life where we do engage in behavior, speeches, or action that are out of alignment with my values? For me, that's almost always emotion as a culprit in that exchange. When I'm in a good mood and I feel at ease and I feel present, I rarely do or say things that I regret. I do pretty good when I feel homeostatic. Right? It's when I become emotional, when I become sad, I become dismissive. When I become angry, I get defensive. When I'm scared, I become catastrophizing. When I'm in shame, I shut down. When I'm in disgust, I want nothing to do with. And that's what happens in those experiences. And then I sometimes do or say things that I regret later. So how do we learn to become, familiar with these? And there's a big setup, I think, for us folks who are in the sort of insight world, because one thing that I've noticed over the years that was really something I had to think about was I would go sit these long retreats. Some of you probably have gone and sat these long insight retreats, 3 months. I've sat the 3-month retreat. I've sat a month long a couple times, 2 weeks many times, tons of 10 days. Is when I go on retreat, I totally crush it. I'm like calm, I'm at ease. I don't have emotional episodes on retreat, mostly because no eye contact, no talking, no phone. They politely, at these insight centers, politely and very skillfully remove all the emotional triggers. I mean, I might get triggered by oatmeal on day 47, but I can usually manage that one because I know on day 47 is going to be oatmeal, and day 48 and the whole damn 3-month retreat is going to be oatmeal. So it doesn't trigger me too bad. But I would notice, I would go sit these long retreats, and I would really feel like I was getting somewhere in my practice, really smoothing out the edges. And then I would go have an exchange with another human being. And I would get emotional. I'd get angry. And I'd be like, I can't believe I just sat for 3 months and this person is going to make me angry? How dare they make me angry? So I don't know, I become blaming and defensive. And so the thing about that so hard is that as much as meditation practice is tremendously valuable in this work I'm talking about and so useful, is that a lot of times the emotional episodes that we have, they typically don't happen on a cushion with our eyes closed sitting quietly. They don't happen in a long retreat in a retreat center. They happen on the day-to-day. They happen in our family relationships, in our romantic relationships. They happen, has anybody ever had an emotional episode at work? Right? Yeah, like every day. And so a lot of it has to do with a lot of these emotional episodes, they happen in the relationship field, in the field of relations. And of course, one of the downsides of practitioners is if we have found that to be, if we have found human relationships to be very, very difficult for us, we can have a tendency to want to withdraw, to retreat, to withdraw. We withdraw more and more and more and more and more and more. And we somehow think, actually, you know what the problem is? It's other people. Other people are the problem. I'm fine. Doing great. I'll go sit in a cave. I'll suffer in silence for eternity by myself. Just keep the other people away. And so for some people, probably nobody in this room, I don't know if anybody here is going to shave their head and put on the brown robes anytime soon, and that we do live in the world of relationships and money. We live, we all have signed up to live in the world of emotional triggers. And so the question becomes, how can I bring my practice of Dharma, my practice of mindfulness, my practice of the heart, into the messy and complicated world of emotion? To the point where I'm going to take responsibility for the emotions that arise in my experience and do the best I can to have a constructive outcome. I'm taking that on as part of my practice. I'm recognizing that my emotions, it's not about who done it. It's just about you were born into a human body and this came on the hard drive. You know, it's true for all of us. It's really part of our shared humanity. And the thing about emotions is they lead to our greatest joys, right? And our most painful sorrows. It's a very, very wide range of experiences we can have as a result of our emotions. So the question becomes, can I use my emotional life as a vehicle, as actually part of the path of liberation? Can I take that on? Can I use sadness, the embodied experience of sadness, as part of my practice, as part of a tool for liberation, rather than this unpleasant feeling I need to learn how to get rid of? You know, because I read the opening line of the Satipatthana that says, this is the direct path for liberation, for overcoming grief, sorrow, lamentation, despair. I read that as if I get Buddhism right, I won't get sad ever again.